Dear listener, if you like this podcast, I want to tell you about something else you might enjoy as well. Every week, I host an online meetup. In each meeting, I give a presentation on some programming topic, or I bring a guest to the group for a discussion, or I do a code review on a member's code base, or I do some kind of consultation with one of our members. Coming to this meetup is kind of like listening to this podcast, except it's live and interactive, which means you get a chance to ask questions and participate in a conversation with other programmers like yourself. The meetup is also a fun place to meet some new friends. To learn more and to sign up, visit codewithjason.com/meetup. Now on to the episode. Hey, today I'm here with Cameron Dutro and Katie Langerman. Cameron and Katie, welcome to the show.
Good to be here. Thanks, Jason.
Yeah. So introductions. First, Cameron, tell us about yourself.
Yeah, I'm Cameron Dutro. I work on GitHub's core productivity team, and I work on the Primer design system and specifically Primer view components. Been working at GitHub for a little over, 2 years now. Time has really flown. And before that, had positions at Salesforce and Twitter and Lumos Labs. So, but this is by far the most interesting job I've ever had. So glad to be in that one. I live in California and yeah, have a couple of kids and looking forward to chatting with you all today.
Awesome. Katie.
Hi, I'm Katie Langerman. I'm a systems designer at GitHub. I work with Cameron on our design system called Primer. Though I'm more in the design org at GitHub, but I sort of span across design and engineering, do a little bit of everything. I love CSS. We could talk about CSS today if you want. I've been at GitHub for a little over 2 years as well, and I'm based in San Diego.
All right. So, Katie, design is obviously a very broad term, and that could mean a lot of different things. I'm curious, in your role as a systems designer, which is a job title that's new to me, so I'm completely unfamiliar with what that means. Can you help me understand what that involves?
Oh yeah, it's a hard one. It is kind of a unique job title. I think other job titles you might have heard that are similar, like design engineer, hybrid designer, developer, but as it relates to design systems, you know, most of us have some kind of design background. I have a background in graphic design and then kind of self-taught in the UI side of things. But what we kind of specialize in, I guess, is seeing larger patterns across an entire product and trying to systemize things, make things reusable. If we see something that goes totally out of the norm of the patterns that we're familiar with, we try to work with other designers and bring things back into alignment or decide that we need to kind of expand to support different patterns and things like that. So we kind of sometimes are like very broad looking at things. We also have the ability to go super deep into specific topics as it relates to UI design.
Okay. Yeah. And the role that it sounds like you perform is like something that a lot of organizations, frankly, don't even think about, I think, because like there are features that need to be built and they just kind of get built in. Well, they're never actually like designed. Their design just kind of happens incidentally. Somebody builds them in whatever way they build them. And then however the mop flops, that's what you get. And there's not necessarily a lot of consistency in the UI throughout the app. So it sounds to me like part of your job is to help ensure that consistency throughout.
Yeah, for sure. And it is unfortunately kind of a rare role. I think not a lot of companies see the need to invest in sort of like very front-end specific engineering roles or design roles, however you want to call it, because we sort of do both. But my hope is that as companies are starting to focus a little bit more on quality, we hear stuff about quality a lot lately, as we're able to kind of ship things even faster with the tech that we're using these days, quality becomes more important. And I think for quality, you need people who really understand the web and design and responsive design and CSS and how to get in there and like ensure that kind of quality across different products.
Yeah, man, there's so many organizations that claim to want a quality product, but then either through, well, the most charitable way to construe it is that they just don't know how to achieve the quality that they want to achieve. And I think part of that is like underemphasizing the importance of planning and design. You know, we in the industry, we have had a backlash against waterfall development. And I think that is all well and good. But I think some things, the pendulum has swung too far the other way in certain ways. I think people conflate being agile and moving fast with being sloppy and not deciding what they're going to do before they start doing it. And obviously, it sounds, Katie, like a big part of your role. Well, okay, so rather than me guessing, like, can you tell me about like at what stage you get involved? Are you kind of like big picture, like this is how things should be built in general? Or like, do you get involved in the design of specific changes or maybe both? Tell me about that.
Yeah, it kind of varies. I think Cameron would agree with this. I find myself all over the place. I kind of am touching like everything, but that's not true of all systems designers. I just can't help myself. But I like to have that really broad context. I kind of like to know what's going on outside of the design systems team on different products and like think about brand new designs that are happening, brand new experiences, but then also focus in on what Primer is shipping, which are much lower level, typically lower level components and patterns. So it sort of just depends. Sometimes I will zoom in. Sometimes a systems designer is a part of a new product experience. Like we might be kind of coaching other designers outside of our team. We have something called a pattern working group session every week. And that's a space for product designers outside of design systems to come in and show us the new stuff that they're doing and like help get alignment. Things that we notice that feel out of place, we'll kind of point it out at that point, and then they can move forward from there. So does that answer your question? It's kind of all over the place.
And it's probably appropriate for us to give the listener kind of a definition of Primer. And for me too, Cameron explained it to me last time he and I talked, but yeah, what is Primer?
Primer is our design system for GitHub. So it's, oh man, it's so hard to explain design systems. It's like a component library is one aspect of a design system. So we kind of manage and maintain the entire design language for GitHub, as you know it, and including brand. So we have like the product side of things that we all use every day, and then the brand side of things, which is more for like landing pages or kind of new pages for events. Like we have Universe coming up this week, so they use Primer Brand to create those experiences. So they're like related in some ways. We share some things called primitives that entails like typography and spacing and sizing, and we all share colors, just they're used in kind of different ways. But we have separate components for our brand side of things. But even across Primer, we have different frameworks. So it started as a purely CSS library like 11, 12 years ago, which still exists today. And it was primarily a library of utility classes, so similar to Tailwind or Bootstrap. And then we started building components in Rails to sort of tie the CSS to some more structure and be able to ship a component. When I think of a component, it's like a shippable item that has everything you need to be able to build a UI. So you shouldn't necessarily need to add your own CSS on top.
And how broad does it go? Like, I can imagine, you know, there's like, well, over the years, I've seen UI component libraries come and go, and some of them have like, okay, if you're going to have a select input, here's what that select input looks like, or maybe they have these like custom select inputs where it's like a type ahead field, that kind of thing. And that's like one level of granularity. And then there's kind of a broader level of granularity where, I don't know, in an application I worked on once, I made a, because I was like the only developer for a long time, I made a decision that anytime there's a text input or any other kind of input on a form, the label for the input would be placed above the input rather than to the left of it. And that was a consistent rule throughout the application. And obviously that kind of design, what do you call it? A style guide. That kind of style guide could be quite a variety of sizes. So I'm curious, like how broadly that stuff applies.
Well, we definitely, I would say, have a lot of rules in place in our components, where we sort of look at things like, what is the default state that we want to recommend? The input is a good example of that. We also have the label on top, but maybe there's a case where we need the label inline to the left. And so we could potentially offer that as a prop, or in Rails, we would call it a param, and give some flexibility there. So we sort of, we tried our best to think of all of the edge cases possible. It's impossible to do that, but you can kind of predict how people are going to want to break your components. And instead of letting them do it on their own, give them a more constrained version of that. And that's something that aligns with the rest of the design. So it's a lot of forward thinking.
Okay. And I have a question for you. You guys can both answer this if you want to. But I'll ask you first, Katie, at least. And this is not like a judgment on how good of a job you guys might be doing. I think this is just like a fact of reality, the way this is. How much does having systems like this save developers from themselves, in the sense of, like, you know, a lot of developers are untrained in visual design and UI design and stuff like that. And so the designs they come up with they don't have very high usability. I'll put it that way. They maybe have relatively low usability, and they're not very aesthetically pleasing. And so how much does a library like this help developers produce things that actually turn out good?
Yeah, I think it has to go a little bit beyond just shipping components. And for us, that means documentation, which Cameron knows a lot about too. We spend a lot of time not only documenting like all the different params you can use for a component, and we use Lookbook for Rails, which we love. Big, big, big fan of Lookbook.
What is that?
Cameron, describe Lookbook. I don't know how to describe it.
Yeah, Lookbook is a Rails engine. It's like Storybook, but for view components. So all of our primer view components are built with the view component framework, which we also maintain. And this guy, Mark Perkins, came up with Lookbook. We actually used to use Storybook for all of our Rails components too. It was not fun. It just wasn't a good fit, right? Like, they weren't good. Trying to weave those together was not the easiest thing to do. So yeah, Mark Perkins came out with Lookbook. Big shout out to Mark. He's been so great about just making the Lookbook experience fantastic. So we have a basically a Rails app that hosts all our components. And then mounted in there is the Lookbook Rails engine. And if you go to primer.style and you look at our documentation, there are previews of the components rendered on the documentation pages, and you can click through to actually go to the Lookbook instance and see all of our components there, rendered for you to use and play with and copy examples from and things like that. So yeah, Lookbook's a Rails engine that lets you preview components.
Okay.
And you can also like interact with the components. So it has a controls, I think is the tab it's called in Lookbook, that lets you, depending on how you configure your previews, you could toggle different things. You could toggle that input label to be on the top or inline, and then it would give you the code that you would need to actually achieve that.
Okay. And for anybody listening who might not know, what is wait, I don't know if I want to say what is view component or what are view components. I think singular, it's called view component, right? Singular, no S.
That's right. Yeah, it's a little confusing. So we there's two projects that we maintain that have similar names. So primer view components, plural, is a library of view components that implement the primer design system for Rails. And then view component, which used to be just GitHub/view component, but is now view component/view component. We have our own organization for it now. That is the framework that lets you write view components. So that's that. There's no actual components in that framework. It's just the framework itself. It's as if it's like Active Record. You don't have actually any models inside Active Record. Active Record itself is the library you use to make models from, right? It powers your model layer. View component is the framework that powers your component layer. It's just a regular Ruby gem, and was sort of pioneered, invented by Joel Hoxley, who I think has been on this podcast before, potentially.
Yeah, a couple times.
He's been on a number of them. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, it's just a way to write components in Ruby and using ERV templates.
Yeah. And I'll say something about view component because I'm a really big fan of view component, but it took me a long time to understand it. I didn't really know if I had a problem that view component solved. Like, I didn't know if it was for me or what. And the way that I ended up articulating to myself, and later I wrote a blog post about it regarding what view component is it's a place to put your view related logic. So Rails apps obviously have like slots you can put stuff in. There's controllers, models, and views. And that works great for a while. But then sometimes once the app gets a little bit bigger, you have some relatively complex view related logic. And it doesn't really feel appropriate in the view because you have all this markup in the view, you know, and the views, I think it's a good idea to keep views mostly static, no, as few moving parts in the views as possible so that they're easy to understand. But then you get to a point where you have unavoidably a lot of logic in some of your views. And it's like, well, where do I want to move this? You could put it in a helper. But it doesn't always feel appropriate there because, I don't remember why, but it doesn't always feel appropriate in a helper. You can move it to a controller, but sometimes that makes the controller harder to understand. It makes the controller less cohesive. It feels like an awkward, it adds an awkward lopsidedness to the controller if you have a bunch of logic related to some like fine grained part of the view. You can move it to a model, but then that's weird too because then you have this model file and it's all like business logic related stuff. And then you have this weird place where there's all this like nitty gritty, fine grained view layer related stuff and it makes that model file lose cohesion. And so the question is, where do you put this view related logic? And view component to me has been a really nice answer for that. You can put the view related logic there. And then your view component files, there's usually a Ruby file and an HTML file with each component. An ERB file, I mean. The ERB file can be relatively static, and the Ruby file in your view component can be cohesive, and it's only about one thing. There's not multiple concerns mixed into there, and that's I found that to be really nice. So sorry for the long-windedness of my explanation, but that's how I think about view component.
Yeah, that's awesome. I did read your blog post, and as usual, very very clear and direct. And I always love reading your writing.
Thank you.
You did a great job. Yeah, view component is like a sort of an answer to like what you just said, sort of the explosion of complexity that you can have in the view layer. And I think you're right to say that when you first start out with a Rails app, you don't necessarily feel that pain. You know, partials seem to work just fine. You've got maybe not even that many partials. And partials, by the way, just being, you know, pieces of your view that you can reuse. The thing though about there's a couple of big reasons why, at least in my mind, sort of in addition to the things that you said, Jason, that Vue components do, or some component system does that that the Rails Vue layer doesn't do. And one of the things that I think is really big is testability. So Vue components are much more easily testable sort of in isolation. It's more difficult in Rails to test, for example, just a partial. Usually what you end up doing is testing the whole Vue that renders that partial. And you also, of course, could then make a mistake and, you know, forget to test one of those views that includes a partial. So you have an untested part of your Vue. But also, it's also in some cases difficult to test a partial or even a regular Vue because there's so many data inputs that go into that. So if I have, you know, a bunch of data that I fetch from my controller and I pass that into the Vue and I want to test that Vue, now I have to pass all of that data from the test into the Vue that I'm testing. And that can be like a lot of setup, a lot of messing around just for to test one specific part of the Vue. Now, Vue components don't necessarily solve that problem directly, but it's, I think, makes it a lot easier to take a piece of that logic, for example, that partial that you've been rendering, and test only that piece of the Vue layer. And that usually will let you only pass in pieces of data that you actually need to render that particular part of the Vue. So testing it is easy or easier than partials and Vues in Rails. Another big benefit is that Vue components are much faster to render than Rails partials. And part of that has to do sort of with the way the Rails Vue layer is architected. So that's also a big win. I think our performance is 3 times faster or something than rendering a partial. That's just like in our micro benchmarks. And then, you know, another big win is just that reusability that we've talked about, where you can take a component like a button, for example. Primer has a button component, and you can drop that in, you know, anywhere you want in your Vue, and it will always render the same way every time, and, you know, look correct and have the correct semantics.
Yeah,
and all of that.
Oh, okay. So I have some comments. Two things. I'll try to remember both of them. With regard to the testing stuff, I don't want to assume that everybody listening has the same context we do. I'll explain something real quick. When I was getting started with Rails, I like took a look at the different kinds of tests one could possibly write for a Rails app. And I was new to testing at this time. Model tests made sense to me. System tests, controller tests, all those made sense to me. But Vue tests or Vue specs, to me, those didn't make a lot of sense. But I think the reason that I thought that is because I was seeing bad examples. And dear listener, one of the things that makes learning testing even harder than it already is, even though it's already really hard, is there's a lot of, frankly, really poor education out there. And you'll see a lot of bad examples very confidently saying, this is how you should do it, when what's being shown to you is really, really no good. So I think what I was seeing is examples of tautological Vue tests. So, you know, there would be a page that says, I don't know, welcome. And then the test would say, assert page contains welcome. And it's like, well, this seems pointless, because it is pointless. You're really not achieving anything at all. Those kinds of tests just assert that the code you wrote is the code you wrote. It could never fail. The kinds of tests that are meaningful, and this doesn't have to have anything with Vue components, but if there's some actual behavior on the page, like with some branching logic or something like that, tests aren't about verification. They're about specification. So saying under these conditions, this happens, under these other conditions, this other thing happens. So I don't write views that say, like, check that this static text appears on the page in a view test. It's only if the view has some actual logic. And what you said, Cameron, is obviously exactly right, that the setup step can be kind of painful, but with a view component, that setup step can be a lot easier. Okay, so that was my one comment. I have a completely unrelated other comment. You said the thing about reusability, Cameron. I remember on this one app I worked on, there was a certain component. It was like a calendar select field, and I had to use it in at least a couple different places. And the setup data was sufficiently involved that like there was no good way to do it. I either had to like duplicate the setup data, or I had to unify it, and there was no great place for it. But once I discovered view component, I rewrote or refactored that that select input, and it allowed me to put all that setup in the view component, and it was just so nice and tidy. And even though I only had to use it like two or three places, it just like made all the code related to it so much easier to understand. So that was great. And then the other thing I want to say about that is everybody has probably experienced the annoyance of when you have, for example, a select input and you need to put something like product.all or something like that. It's even worse. Like when there's some like, it's not product.all, but it's like a little bit of a longer query, something like that. And you have to either put that like individually in several different controller actions, or you have to have like a before action, and then it gets a little bit hard to follow. It's like, okay, I'm doing this before action in like four of these seven actions. Like, when is it happening and when is it not? It makes things hard to follow. But if you have a view component, you don't put any of that stuff in your controller. You can just put that query in the view component, and it's just nice and tidy, and it's really great.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, encapsulating the logic is like another really, I think, big win, and that enables things like testability and reusability. I was going to make a point too. I'm going to forget my train of thought now. You were mentioning sort of it's hard to know sort of when your like the setup for rendering a view can be kind of difficult to reason about. And I think that's another, like one of the really big things that I really like about view component is this issue of like sometimes a partial in Rails will rely on there being an instance variable set in the controller that, you know, in order to render that partial, and the partial might not even be rendered directly by the controller. It might be rendered several views down, and it relies, you know, several layers down in the view, and it relies on this instance variable that you set in the controller. So the next time you want to reuse that partial, you have to remember to set that instance variable in the controller action, which may, you know, be again something that is totally, it's so far removed from the actual place where that instance variable is used that you've just got this sort of giant like leaky state machine thing where like, you know, you forget to set one instance variable and it doesn't do what you want. In a view component world, you have to explicitly pass all of that data into the component. And if a component several layers down needs that information, it'll ask for it and you'll be required, you know, via keyword arguments or whatever to pass that data in. And if you don't, it'll blow up with an error saying didn't receive this keyword argument, right? Just like you would expect in a regular Ruby method. So it's bringing sort of the power of Ruby to the view layer in a much more explicit way that makes the data that it receives a lot more obvious that it's receiving and handling and needs to work with.
Yes. My goodness, that is one of the most painful things that I come across in Rails applications, because you'll open up some partial and there'll be an instance variable in there. And sometimes it's easy to trace, but sometimes you're like, where is this thing coming from? Especially if it's like not a very distinctive name of that variable and things of that name appear all over the place. And it's like, it's just sometimes it's basically impossible to find out where that thing is coming from. And so if that passing has to be explicit, then you can trace it all the way up to where it comes from. One of the first things a lot of programmers learn is that global variables are bad because they create this mystery, because you don't know what happened on the way from where that variable got instantiated to where it gets used. And it's such a like fundamental, well-known principle, and yet we're using global variables all the time in Rails applications. And it's like you can think of views and partials like functions, and it's like in a Rails app, you would never like set a global variable in one file and then include a file, which includes another file, which includes another file, and then use that variable there. So why do we think that's okay in views? So this view component idea to me just seems very logical.
You know, it's funny you said global variables and calling a method or that views are like functions. It actually so happens in Rails that views are functions. So all the views in your entire app, this is sort of like how the sausage is made in Rails. All the views that you have in a Rails app are actually compiled in, like, using the ERB engine. So ERB produces some Ruby code. That Ruby code is then injected into a method, so dynamically put into a method that has a special name that's like a unique name with a bunch of numbers and letters and stuff in it. So it takes that ERB code, puts it in this sort of method wrapper, puts all of the methods into a giant module, and then includes that module into your controller. So when you say render a partial, it translates the name of that partial into that special method name and then calls that method. So that's exactly what's actually happening behind the scenes. Every time you render a view, it's actually going and just calling a method that renders your ERB to the page. And you're absolutely right. Whatever instance variables are available in that class, the modules included into are available to every view. So it's exactly what you said. It's a global variable it's scoped to the controller, but it's a global variable that you have access to in every single one of your view methods because of the way that it works with the module and the methods that it defines. So it's kind of, I don't know if you meant to say that sort of as a general comment on how Rails works, but that is in fact how Rails works. It's kind of a crazy system.
That's funny. No, I was just kind of making an analogy, but I didn't realize that's exactly how it works. That's interesting.
Yeah.
Credit where credit is due. I didn't realize all that stuff on my own. A lot of it was pointed out to me by Joel Hawksley when we talked in our other episodes. And if anybody wants to go even deeper into view components, the most recent episode I did with Joel, I think he did a really good job of explaining a lot of the concepts. Zooming back out and getting back to primer and all that stuff. How does, I'm not sure where we want to go from here, but Katie, does the stuff me and Cameron talked about stir up any thoughts for you?
A few. Yeah, the thing that kind of stands out to me as a designer the most with view components is, and related to testing, is the ability to do visual regression testing on them. So this is a huge part of Primer and how we work across all of our frameworks, but specifically in Primer view components, we're able to use a tool called Playwright on all of our pull requests. So if you were to make a visual change to a primer view component, open your PR, Playwright is going to run a test against our deployed lookbook instance, which we deploy on every pull request. So it gives you like an updated view of the changes that you have made to the component. And it checks for visual diffs. And if it finds something has changed, it will then post screenshots to your pull request. And it gives you this really neat like slider tool that you can kind of go back and forth in between the before and after and see what has changed. We didn't always have that. It's kind of a recent addition, I guess, probably in the last year. But it's so useful as a designer. You don't always know how your changes are going to impact the component that you changed, but also other components that use that component. It's like it could just cascade. So it's really cool to have a visual screenshot of the changes that you've made. And I think using view components makes that possible for us.
Okay. Tell me if I'm understanding this correctly. So first of all, just an explanation for the listener. So if you weren't familiar with view component before, you might not have the context you need in order to understand lookbook. And I've never used lookbook. But if you're using view component, then you no longer have this like dependency. You don't have to spin up the whole Rails app in order to render a component, right? Yeah. And so it sounds like with this Playwright tool, you can, if you've used this component 10 times in the deployed app, and then the designer's working on the component and they made some change to the component. They want to regression test that component to make sure it doesn't, their change doesn't cause any unexpected regressions, so they can compare, they can like take, I'm struggling with how to articulate how it goes, but like they can basically like get a preview of how the new version of this would work against the currently deployed instances of where that component is used, and any regressions visually could be automatically detected by this Playwright tool. Is that right?
Yep. Yeah, exactly. And so those snapshots are like a snapshot in time. So we actually, all of those images live inside of the repo. And so it's always comparing against the last time somebody merged something. So they're like, they're up to date, but it just, you know, it's worth mentioning that. And it's not always about a regression either. It might be, I want to see that the change, the improvement that I made looks how I anticipate it to look in all different scenarios. And another like nice thing about Lookbook, I love Lookbook so much, is like I mentioned earlier, having access to controls to toggle different states of a component means that the way that you structure your previews can impact your snapshot tests if you do visual regression testing. So we have a set of guidelines we kind of try to follow for how we write previews. We always set up one preview that we call Playground. And that one gives you full access to all of the controls. So you can see what a component can do to its limits, like everything possible. And then we try to write feature previews. So for each control that you could toggle that would change the state, at least visually, of the component, we'll write an individual preview for that and call it like label top or label left or primary button, default button. So since they all have individual previews, then we can regression test that specific preview and have a snapshot of that format of the component. And so that's kind of where we're at now. And it did get a little out of hand. We're like snapshotting way too many things. And so I worked with one of our coworkers, John Rohan, to basically, I don't really know how we did this, but we like crafted something to be able to specify which previews you want to snapshot and then exclude other ones. So you're not like, you don't want to overwhelm a pull request or overwhelm your repo with too many snapshots. So it's good to be kind of critical about which ones make sense to test against. And that's, I think, where a designer can come in handy, because we know which things we really care about.
Yeah. And I suspect that certain parts of this whole picture apply only at GitHub level scale, and for a team of like three developers or something like that, it's maybe not quite so much part of the picture.
Like, I don't know if I would agree.
No?
I think you could start like, I mean, there's so many things, there's so many tooling that I wish we had 2 years ago, like when we were, I guess we were kind of technically larger 2 years ago, our team, we're a little bit on the small side right now. But I mean, the sooner you can get these best practices in place with a small team, that just makes it so much easier to grow and add new people. You don't want to be dealing with these things when you're trying to onboard new developers or new designers. You want like a system in place to be able to easily bring in new people.
What if somebody said to you, I don't know, Katie, this sounds like a waste of time. We're just three people. We don't need all this overhead.
Talk to me next time you break production.
Okay.
We'll see how that feels. Been there. And every time we break production, we're like, oh, we got to improve our visual regression testing.
Yeah. You know, it's funny too, because when we say break production, that means a bunch of things from a design systems perspective. Like, it could mean that we shipped a component and we removed part of the public API and forgot to update that like on github.com. And so we get an actual stack trace in Ruby in the page 404s. But it could also just mean like all of a sudden, like the green buttons, primary buttons are now blue for some reason, which is not correct. Right. So that's another sort of instance where you could break production, like in the sense of like, you know, a back end engineer, breaking is a little different in that sense. But, you know, if all of a sudden all of the buttons turn blue, one thing that that may impact is people who have different types of color blindness. Maybe they won't be able to tell that button is supposed to be a primary button, for example. So it, you know, it, we think a lot about just the accessibility levels of our components too. And sometimes even what seem like really minor changes maybe to a backend engineer could be a really big problem for a front-end engineer or somebody who is, you know, used to using the site with a certain level of accessibility. Suddenly they can't use it anymore because, you know, the button color changed, which again seems like a really innocuous, minor, non-breaking change to maybe backend eng, but to somebody who needs that and relies on that, it can be a really big deal.
Okay, yeah,
I would also ask Jason the question of like, do you think that people shouldn't write tests? Does a three-person team, do they need to write, you know, tests for their code?
Yeah, well, okay, so for context, Katie, part of why I was asking that question that a hypothetical person might ask you is because I myself didn't have a firm grip yet on the benefits of these practices. I think I'm starting to understand more now. Yeah, and Cameron, to answer your question, it's like testing helps no matter what size you're at. And just because you're small doesn't mean you're not going to suffer from the symptoms of not having tests. An example that I came up with in my mind just now was like, and tell me if this like fits. I think it does. So maybe there's a scenario where you make a change and all your tests still pass, your like regular RSpec tests or whatever, because the behavior still technically is the same. But maybe a common sense test would show you that it's not really meeting the requirement. Like, for example, you could have a select input where, you know, let's say it's a very custom select input. And previously when it was working, you know, the down arrow was on the right-hand side. It was connected to the other part of the select input. It worked like any other select input does. And then you made some kind of visual change, and now the drop-down button, there's a line break, and so it appears down below, and it looks like really weird, and like it would totally confuse people. The automated tests still pass because it's still the same element with the same ID and stuff like that, but any human looking at it would be like, this is broken. And it sounds like these practices can catch those kinds of problems.
Yeah, absolutely. And especially as we talked about earlier, if you're on a team that doesn't really prioritize hiring CSS developers, and yet you're still trying to write CSS and you're not very confident in it, well, this is a way to ensure quality with the designs that you're putting out, because you might make a change in CSS that you don't fully understand the ramifications of it. And the code looks fine. It's valid CSS. It's kind of hard to know what is valid in CSS without seeing it rendered. And that screenshot could really save you.
Okay. And just another comment on the value of adopting good practices early. I think it's a good idea to pay attention to design early on, not just aesthetic design, but like the kind of bigger picture design. There's so many different kinds of design, but like this consistency and such that we've been talking about, if those kinds of things aren't attended to, and I'm curious if you have thoughts on this, Katie. If those kinds of things aren't attended to early on, then you'll make certain decisions, maybe not the best decisions, and everything will grow around those. It's kind of like, I don't know if you've ever seen like somebody put a bike in the crotch of a tree, and then the tree like grows around the bike, and the bike is stuck in the tree. Like these early design decisions will get ossified because everything grows up around it and like traps it in. And then by the time you're really feeling the pain and you want to change it, it's going to be prohibitively expensive and risky to make that change. Yeah. Any comments on that topic, Katie?
Yeah. It's really hard I don't think you can avoid it. You're always going to have to make breaking changes down the line. You can't predict everything. Like One example for us at GitHub is we're looking at border colors for our form components. That's something that's so deeply integrated into the design language at GitHub. We use the same border color for everything, and GitHub is kind of a boxy design. So how do you now refactor that and make it feel like GitHub still and impact the two different frameworks that we support across the board seamlessly? These things are like inevitable. And part of having a design system in place is to hopefully make it easier to make those kinds of sweeping changes. Like we were talking about earlier, duplicating code a bunch of times. Were you going to go change a class on that duplicate code like 60 times in your application? No. If you use a view component, you can make those changes in one place and it will cascade out. But managing those big design changes is really hard. And it can often feel like you're putting out fires working on a design systems team for that reason.
Yeah, I can imagine. I imagine it's very tough when you have such a large site to keep everything, when you make a new change to the design system to keep everything reconciled and stuff like that. It's almost time for us to conclude. I want to say that this episode has been brought to you by Shure Microphones. I said that because we all have Shure microphones. It's not really sponsored by Shure, dear listener. But that is why we all sound so good in this episode. Anyway, I'm going to ask each of you individually, if you want to share any links for people to check out online and stuff like that. I'll start with you, Cameron. Any place people should go to check you out online?
Well, I will say, so I have CameronDutro.com that has a couple of blog posts. I haven't been super active up there, but just, you know, my musings on, you know, mostly tech things there. The documentation for Primer is at primer.style. That's the main home for everything we do on Primer. There is, it has recently undergone a nice sort of refresh. We call it the new information architecture. So now, instead of having sort of separate sites for Primer view components and Primer React components, they're all sort of fused into one nice website. One thing that we didn't get to talk about that I do want to also mention before we sign off is that another really important aspect to a design system, at least for us, is that Primer and having a design system lets us also make a lot more headwinds in the accessibility space. That's one of the big reasons why there's a lot of investment in Primer happening at GitHub right now, because we could make a single component accessible. And then if, you know, a team were to go use that component, then the page that they work on or the pages they work on are now sort of by default more accessible than they were before. So accessibility is a big reason. The company is right now trying to hit this goal of Microsoft Accessibility Standard Level C. They go from A, I think double A actually, all the way to F. And then we're trying to hit Level C by 2025. So Primer is a big factor in that work. So yeah, those are the links. And so just accessibility is a big deal. I just wanted to make sure we talked about that at least briefly. Not just for our company, but I think it should be a big deal for everybody. So
And that's a whole episode's worth of content right there. Maybe we can do a follow-up episode sometime. Katie, how about you?
Oh yeah, I just want to add, we have a team of accessibility designers. I think that is amazing, and more people should hire accessibility designers and accessibility engineers. I think it would be very cool for you to have an accessibility engineer on your show. They are just the best people to work with, and it's changed Primer for the better to have those folks on our team. So huge shout out to them. And they have lots of guidelines on primer.style as well, so you can kind of read a little bit more about what they're up to. So for me, I would have linked primer.style as well, but Cameron's got that covered for us. You can find me on Twitter. I'm going to keep calling it that, at Katie Langerman, and all of the other five social networks that I'm trying to use. I also have my own podcast. It's called Complimentary with an E, co-hosted with Anthony Hobday. And it's a design podcast. So if you're an engineer who's kind of interested in more of the fundamentals about design, we try to keep kind of brief episodes just talking about visual design, interaction design, those kinds of things. So check it out wherever you listen to podcasts.
Nice. Well, Cameron and Katie, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.